Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me today is co-host Nicholas Hoffman.
Hey everyone, Nick Hoffman here. I'm host of Myopia Defend Your Childhood, a podcast where we watch the movies you liked as a kid and judge you for them. I came to John with this book to kind of recreate my childhood literature. So I'm excited to be here.
Strangely enough, this play I did not read in high school. The play we're reading this time is Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, probably his most famous play. I have a feeling that in high school you were either assigned The Crucible or Death of a Salesman, and we got The Crucible. But I did read Death of a Salesman as a teenager. There was this time where I thought I should be reading a lot of plays, and so I read an awful lot of Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams on my own. And I don't know that they stuck in my head as well as they would have if I had had a class. Also, around the time of my high school years, there was a famous production of Death of a Salesman with Dustin Hoffman and with a very young John Malkovich playing Biff. And that got made into a TV movie, which you can see if you want to. The TV movie version of it is on Hulu and is probably the closest we're going to get to a canonical version of the play on film. And you read this in high school?
Yeah, and it's funny to rewatch it and reread it and kind of follow along, because like you were mentioning, the Dustin Hoffman, Charles Durning, John Malkovich version is incredible. And it's filmed like a play. And that was the version we kind of watched after we had read it in class and talked about it and broke it down. But, you know, I went to kind of a wealthy-ish Catholic high school, you know, and I guess this was one of those things that they made us read to kind of teach some people modesty. You know, it's interesting kind of following Arthur Miller's career. This is one of those, I think this was the last play that he did before his friend went before the McCarthy hearings.
Oh, Ilya Kazan?
Exactly. The only thing he did in between then and Death of a Salesman was translating someone else's play. So it's kind of interesting to see how this is about the death of the American dream and why it's not important to be well. It's almost like, again, from a high schooler's perspective, it's like an anti-bullying message kind of too, which is weird. But yeah, I in fact reread it on an old high school copy I even have still, which I'll put on the Facebook group page. If you guys aren't on the Facebook group, you should be. It's a good group. But yeah, no, it's still marked up with the orange and red highlighter I had back in high school. Yeah,
so that's sweet. You know, I as an aside, I will just say I never learned to underline books well. I grew up with a horror of underlining books because I had this feeling that somehow I was going to ruin the books. So then I started taking a pencil and writing notes in the margin as light as I can. And so very little survives of notes from high school. However, during lectures, I used to take down notes in the form of lengthy comic strips. and some of those survive to this day. So one of these days, I guess I'll pull those out.
It's funny you say that, because, you know, I'm reviewing for my PhD exams at this point, and two-thirds of it's library books. And the thought of marking up a library book is horrifying to me. But this play especially has flashbacks and then flashbacks within flashbacks and then characters which only Willie can see. And frankly, I remember the teacher saying, if you don't mark this up, you're going to be lost. So I have a different color highlighter for when he's referring to someone who doesn't exist. Because it's the only way I could keep track of everything.
Well, this is a good point to bring up here, because this was, of course, the major stumbling block for me reading this on my own. I was not well-versed in stagecraft at the time, And this book does take place partially inside Willie's mind, and partially those are memories that Willie has, and partially they are fantasies that Willie has, and the memories and the fantasies interweave with the characters on the stage. If you see it performed, there's absolutely no trouble at all following what's going on, but it is a difficult play to read as literature. A little bit about Arthur Miller. Everyone knows Arthur Miller, one of the most famous playwrights of the post-war era, and he's best known for Death of the Salesman, but he also wrote All My Sons, The Crucible, and A View from the Bridge. When I was in college, I went and saw a production of two short plays of his called Two-Way Mirror, and this was in 1989, and I was shocked at that point to find out that he was still alive and writing plays, because he seemed mm-hmm. to me like he was just the guy from way back when. And in fact, he did live until 2005, and he kept writing for most of his life. This play, Death of a Salesman, was probably his biggest success and what brought his name out to the public. And you mentioned Elia Kazan, the director who directed this, but who also directed a lot of the most famous Tennessee Williams plays. He was responsible for the original staging of The Skin of Our Teeth, which we read earlier for Sophomore Lit, and who went on to do such movies as On the Waterfront. Now, he was beloved in his day and then hated because he ratted out some people in the House Un-American Committee.
Activities Committee.
Right. He named names and ended the careers of several writers in Hollywood. We can all probably remember it was just recently in like 2009 that he was given a lifetime Oscar achievement, and mm-hmm. a lot of actors refused to acknowledge the award.
Yeah.
So there's a long memory there. But what Elia Kazan and Arthur Miller had in common was they came out of the New Theater in New York, which were early proponents of what was called the Method School of Acting. And here we're talking about the Method School of Lee Strasberg, which is a kind of acting which is what everyone makes fun of when they make fun of actors, where they say, what's my motivation? That's basically Strasberg.
The other thing that Kazan and Miller are a part of, it's not just this big acting community, which it is, and, you know, they kind of redefine what American drama is as well. Like, you know, like you were saying, Elia Kazan becomes this kind of cornerstone of of what we think of as American deep drama. You know, I think his first straight film was A Gentleman's Agreement with Gregory Peck, and that is all about anti-Semitism. Like, nothing here is subtle. It's all about the kind of dark undercurrents that exist in America, you know. And he does Streetcar, and he does On the Waterfront, and he does East of Eden, and he has this kind of really kind of, it's hard to think about in a modern context, because we just don't have a play culture, dramatic culture in the same way. But he's also writing at a very dark time. Like, you brought up the House Un-American Activities Committee already. And, you know, a lot of these plays and a lot of these movies we're talking about are really trying to show how in post-World War II, early Cold War America, everyone's promised all this stuff as far as the American dream goes, and it just isn't panning out. And, you know, honest frustration about it. I mean, you mentioned On the Waterfront already. It's about unions who are supposed to be protecting people aren't. They're as corrupt as the management at the top, and the one person who wants to stand up to it is essentially being beaten back down. And so it's kind of interesting that he's the one, you know, Elia Kazan is this person who puts these plays on and puts these movies together, and he's the one who ends up naming names. And Arthur Miller, of course, is the one who then writes the other play everyone knows him for, The Crucible, soon after. I think a year after Kazan ends up in front of the House on American Connectivities Committee. And we kind of see that, you know, there is this undercurrent in American culture of the death of the American dream or whatever, and the threats that come out of it. I know this play has been derided as Marxist in tones, and in fact, one of the last things Arthur Miller did as an active participant in drama is he directed this play in China in the 1980s, as, you know, as the director himself, which is kind of crazy. But yeah, I kind of am impressed, like, tying all this together. You know, when you're in high school, like, and I read this, I read the play for what it was, you know, this thing about, you know, he practically screams Catcher in the Rye, you know, like, about being a phony from both perspective. But the more you kind of look into it, everyone looks at The Crucible as this, oh, you know, it's almost like a nudge-nudge trivia thing. This is actually about the McCarthy hearings, blah, 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 blah. But Death of a Salesman is actually some ways much more political because it's not as much on the nose. It's just much bleaker, I think.
Right. Now, it's good to resituate ourselves back into the world of high school because we've spoken a lot about extra-textual things here, and understanding what the political currents were and what the aesthetic currents were in 1949 is a useful exercise, I think, as adults. But as kids, given this book, I think the bleakness that you mentioned is really what comes to the forefront. This is a very unrelentingly dark play and very somber and kind of hard, I think, when you're a teenager to read, or maybe not. Maybe you're the kind of a bleak, you know, goth kid. Any other high school memories before we go into the actual play itself?
You know, it's funny. I thinking about this in high school and remember watching the movie, and it's very emotional, especially at the end. There's even little weird bits. Like you said, 84's production, which became a movie in 1985, was such a big deal that it was part of the audio montage of my version of Encarta 95. including a clip of like Maya Angelou at Clinton's inaugural address, and they just had Charlie's eulogy. You don't understand, Willie was a salesman, like as part of it, because it's almost so much of the literature of, you know, kind of, I don't know, it's almost a semiotics of what a salesman is. You know, it's a depressing position. And so for me in high school, like, you know, kind of tearing this play up, it's, you know, on one hand, it's kind of the idea that you can fail at life and that people who put all this pressure on who you're going to be and being well-liked comes over and over again. That kind of message is really hard to wrap your mind around in high school when all you want to be is well-liked, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I do remember having... This is a play that... if I had read it, you know, again, as like a book club kind of thing, it would have different discussion points. But in high school, I do remember having a lot of discussion. This one, because the language is fairly simple. You know, it's not like when we did Hamlet and people had a hard time wrapping their minds around what was even being said, right? People understand what he's saying. It's just the emotions just aren't necessarily there. So it's kind of, it sparked a lot of discussion. And I do remember spending a lot of time for a play that, you know, you perform in just over 2 hours, it really does have a lot to it.
Right. One other thing I'd like to say, though, just before we get too far into this, is this play was written at a time when people still read plays as literature. They were circulated as literature. And one of the ways that you know that is it starts with some very substantial stage directions. And I always find it hilarious to read stage directions from the 30s and 40s and on into the 50s because the authors or playwrights want to give all kinds of thematic notes to here. We have this opening where we say, he unlocks the door, comes into the kitchen, and thankfully lets his burden down, feeling the soreness of his palms. A word sigh escapes his lips. It might be, oh boy, oh boy. He closes the door, then carries his cases out into the living room. And then we are told that his wife has developed an iron repression of her exceptions to Willie's behavior. She more than loves him. She admires him. As though his mercurial nature, his temper, his massive dreams and little cruelties served her only as sharp reminders of the turbulent longings within him. And the thing that makes me laugh about this is, if you've ever taken an acting class, one of the first things they tell you to do is to take your marker and cross out all these stage directions, because they are of absolutely no help whatsoever to an actor. Particularly interesting that those directions are in there in a play that's associated with method acting, because that's kind of the antithesis of method acting, which tries to seek some sort of interior reality rather than finding the thematic truth.
Sure. And like mine apparently goes even further, because it has some of Elia Kazan's actual stage directions in it, which are even more flowery. The first thing I see is, you know, act one, and that says, a melody is heard, played upon a flute. And it just goes on like this for paragraphs and paragraphs.
Right, right. Sure. Well, this melody played upon the flute is, you know, we're given a motivation for this later on in the play, but let's talk about this. The play starts with our hero, Willie Loman, who is, we're told, is an aging salesman. We're told he's over 60. He's returned home. He has apparently almost had an accident where he ran his car off the road, but his wife is exceedingly worried because this apparently has been happening a lot. And Willie says that he was on his way to make his salesman rounds up in New England. He lives in New York. It's not specified exactly where. I assume it's might be Brooklyn, because he lives in an old house that is being encroached upon by new developments all around him, apartment buildings all around him. But at one time in the past, it was open fields around him. And in any case, he says that he can't go on to New England. He needs to ask his boss if he can be relocated to a beat here in New York. From the beginning, Willie is presented as a man of wildly swinging moods. He yells at his wife, and then he turns around and is highly affectionate to her. He seems to get lost in his thoughts very easily, and he talks about his car, and it seems to be a pivot point of memory for him, because he suddenly starts to talk about a car he had a long ago in the past. And these moments of pivoting memory are very important to this play, and I think that if anyone has ever read The Sound and the Fury, I think that this is kind of the model that Miller is coming from, is the kind of stream of consciousness novels of the 20s and 30s, but now being taken into the world of the theater in the late 40s.
I'm just trying to think of how to wrap your mind around this. Like, the play in structure is, you know, in some ways we're led to believe that this is not an unusual thing, right? Like you said, his mind is kind of going, and it's kind of this 19, like you said, late 40s, early 50s version of mental illness, as though his past is finally catching up to him. You know, you couldn't write a character like Willie Loman nowadays and his problem is he's a failure at life. You know, he has dementia. He's talking to himself. He sees people that aren't there. But, you know, in this context, it's literally the ghosts of his past. You know, the pivot point is unlike previously, when he's come home and effectively not been able to make it, I think, to Boston, or he's supposed to be going to a sales call. His sons are home for the first time. One in particular is the first time in years and years and years since a critical plot point. And because of that, the past is all the more omnipresent to him. And so we're shown him, you know, like you were saying, John, it's him talking not just about the car and how he thought he was in his old red Chevy instead of the Studebaker he drives now. It's that, you know, his neighbor Charlie bought a General Electric refrigerator and he bought some brand which is like, you know, the Kroger Plus brand or whatever. And it just doesn't work out, you know, the generic brand. And it keeps burning out before it's even paid off. And we have this kind of clash of how he feels like he should be living versus how he's actually living. And it's as though he can't even get that far.
Now, I think I like what you say, especially about this being a 1940s version of mental illness. Because one thing that one of the things that frustrates me immensely about this play is the way in which Miller has a kind of a real pop psychology version of Freudianism that runs throughout this play, insofar as everyone in this play is damaged more or less, and the play is going to be about locating the moment in their formation that caused that. And it's sort of like there's going to be this one incident from Willie's past that will explain everything, or this one incident from his son Biff's past that will explain everything. And that is not the way that people work.
Yeah.
And but it is the way that I think people were thinking about Freud at this time. Freud had become immensely popular in the 20s and 30s, and particularly had trickled down into literature. And there was a lot of interest in interior life. If you look back a decade or two in the American theater, you had things like Eugene O'Neill's Strange Interlude, which almost no one remembers today, but which exists as a bunch of jokes people made about it in like Marx Brothers films.
Well, I mean, and in some ways, too, you have to realize that Willie Loman and, you know, especially Biff are like the sequel to Horatio Alger characters. Like they really did, you know, want to be well liked, and they thought they were going to work hard. And, you know, Willie really did like, and we even have the Horatio Alger character in the, you know, the kind of titular salesman when he talks about how that salesman died, you know, in his lounge coat and his slippers, drinking from a martini glass, making phone calls. And then everyone shows up when he dies, you know. And Happy is still living in the delusion of the kind of Horatio Alger story.
Aside from Willie, we have Willie's wife, whose name is Linda, and their two kids that we've mentioned are Biff and Happy. Mm-hmm. And Biff is the kind of prodigal son, as you mentioned. He's been missing for several years. He's back. He was at one point the beloved, favored son. We're going to get a flashback that pretty soon here that shows him as having been an athletic phenom when he was a kid, and everyone expected great things of him. Happy is the younger son, and right now he seems to be kind of a bon vivant, and he likes to talk about his sexual exploits a lot with Biff. There's a lot of funny stage directions that, again, as you mentioned, it can be confusing if you read this play as a play, but aren't confusing when you see it performed, because the opening sequence has Willie and Linda talking in the kitchen, and then we have some sort of a scrim fade away to the other room where we can see Biff and Happy listening in on Willie and Linda. So it's important to keep in mind as you read this who's in which room, because the dialogue is happening simultaneously.
And frankly, the plot is around these four people and a kind of fractured relationship between what they want to be and how they end up, as opposed to Next Door, where you have Charlie and Howard, right? who are father and son. Charlie's like the, you know, about Willie's age. He has always been to, I guess, Willie almost like, it's weird. It seems like Willie thinks of him as the failure because he always talks about how almost simple-minded Charlie is. But Charlie has played things much more cautiously. And most of the play, it seems like Willie's jealous of him, even though he talks down to Charlie constantly. And then you have Howard, who is Biff's age, was the nerdy type, to the point where in flashbacks, Willie's even calling him anemic. Like, he's calling him a nerd. And, you know, they talk about the whole time how, you know, Howard allows Biff to cheat off of him in math and stuff. And he's just kind of this nerdy, squirrely little guy who, to Willie, is a failure because he's not well-liked.
The first flashback, and there are several of these flashbacks, in Willie's mind, his interior life becomes the action of the stage, and his sons are there, but they are back in high school, and everything, the dialogue becomes very stilted and funny, and it becomes sort of a scene out of like Archie comics or something, where like everything is great, is Americana. Biff is the star of the football team, and Happy is kind of his squire, almost going around carrying his helmet to into the field with him, and as you mentioned, Howard is also wants a part of the glory of Biff. He wants to be there. He wants to help Biff with his studies so that Biff can get into college. And as you watch this, you realize that this is memory that is tainted with Willie's own longings. Mm-hmm. So you don't trust any of what you're seeing in a way. It's sort of like the basic action may be true, but the characterization seems false or off or at least simplified through the lens of Willie's dementia.
Well, and you realize when you see it, I mean, like you said, it's all rose-colored glasses. The dialogue suddenly becomes much more witty and quippy somehow. You know, like, it becomes light and, you know, everyone always has the line, like you said, like out of an Archie comic, which is actually a really kind of concise way to put it like that. But the thing is, there's these little dark corners of it. Like, all of a sudden, Biff admits to stealing footballs from the locker room. And Willie's just like, oh, boys will be boys. And Howard's like, you know, the cops are looking for him or whatever, which comes up again and again and again. And you're like, well, Willie, why are you remembering the dark parts? It's as though his conscience is slowly trying to creep in, but he won't even listen to that. Right. Right. And it gets bleaker and bleaker because Willie, as he gets closer to the end of the play, he realizes more and more that his world that he has created is crashing down around him. Something that even Biff says, you filled me so full of like big ideas that when someone actually told me what to do, I couldn't take it, you know? And it's as though he steals and he does these things because he figures it's what he always should get. Meanwhile, even in this scene, I think three times, I know we're two scenes in, I apologize, but Happy keeps saying, "Hey dad, I lost weight." And his dad ignores everything Happy says the entire time in order for Biff to get more glory.
We switch back to the present day or the actual world of the play. And we can see from the exterior what Willie's fantasies look like. His wife, Linda, and the two sons confer amongst themselves and say, has he always been this way? Is he getting worse? The other thing that's kind of frustrating about this to me is from a perspective from today, it seems pretty clear that Willie has Alzheimer's. And I don't know to what extent an understanding of dementia was prevalent in the popular culture at this time. But it seems like the mechanics of it aren't quite right. I worked as an orderly at a nursing home. I dealt with a lot of Alzheimer's patients. I know kind of the way in which they move in and out of their lucidity and in and out of memories, and it doesn't quite resemble the theatricality of what's going on the stage.
Well, I mean, it's like saying, I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. It's kind of like learning about, you know, amnesia from a soap opera, you know, like, because what happens is, and everyone says this at various points to Biff, who refuses to listen, but, you know, if you give him good news, he's more focused. It really is. I mean, again, like you were saying, it's very a Freudian interpretation of this, where it's as though bad memories are popping up. So he's literally debating with himself and his brother Ben, who is almost a myth. You know, like, he clearly may or may not have existed at one point. Charlie says, you know, they're playing cards, a game called Casino, which, you know, it's they might as well have made up. It's like a game of gamble. You know, it involves cards. And halfway through, he goes, yeah, I got a letter from his wife. He died last week. And he says it so flippantly because that's not what matters. The matters is the memory and buried deep in Willie's head.
Before we get to Uncle Ben, who is a very important character, there is also briefly in the first act a flashback to another woman that that Willie had an affair with. And frustratingly to me, she is called the woman.
The woman.
we're given a name, I believe. It's like Miss Francis or something like that. She's mentioned later on as, but she's just called the woman.
Yeah.
And it seems to me to be that kind of, she only exists as a device in a way. And the fact that Miller refers to her as such kind of sticks in my craw a little bit because it...
Well, and as I recall, we're introduced to her laughing, kind of giggling, and then she gets a pseudo line. And it's, like you said, it's not until mid-second act that we even get more out of Miss Francis, Miss Forsyth, something like that. But yeah, no, it's not... Maybe we should also say, for those of you who haven't read this play, it is as baffling to talk about in some ways as we're making it. It essentially takes place over 36 hours, but there's so many intercut flashbacks told almost exclusively from Willie's perspective until the epilogue that it stretches it much out. But, you know, Willie comes home nearly driving off the road. Then we have that night where, like John was saying, it fluctuates between his point of view and the brothers talking. Then Charlie coming over, but it's really just maybe an hour or so that night as Willie is restless and people are trying to get him to go to bed with the promise that the next morning, Biff's going to get his life together, Happy is going to get his life together, everyone's going to get their life together, including Willie, who's going to talk to his boss about staying in New York. And then Act Two, everything literally falls back apart. Right. We have a dinner scene and then we have a night scene and that's really it. That's the play. And then in between, he's flashing back to high school to this one Freudian kind of moment where the world essentially crashes down and nothing is ever able to be rebuilt again. They even talk about that you can't even see the sky anymore, as though they're buried before the play's even started.
Let's talk a little bit about Uncle Ben. Uncle Ben is Willie's brother who may or may not exist. It's unclear. It seems like there has to have been someone there, because there are moments where characters in the play acknowledge things, such as Willie at one point talks about a diamond watch fob and his wife said, "You pawned that." He does talk with Charlie about an Uncle Ben, but Uncle Ben is Willie's, if he does exist at all, is Willie's older brother who went off into the world and made a great success of himself. But he made a great success of himself in completely ridiculous, implausible, fantastical ways. He went to Africa and found a diamond mine. He went to Alaska and sold timberland. Mm-hmm. And when he shows up, he's this dashing in Willie's mind, in another one of, in some of his other flashbacks, but not even quite flashbacks. They're more like Ben is another character who's walking onto stage and inhabiting the world as it is now, out of the past. I don't know, but Ben is this dashing, crazy gentleman adventurer.
Well, and I mean, he represents all that Willie obviously wants to be. He, on one hand, he's rich and well-respected, which is something that Willie keeps coming back to. But the other thing is to Willie, he's that moment of Freudian regret. Because apparently at one point, he came to Willie and said, look, if you come with me now, we both can be rich. And, you know, sometimes it looks as though Willie's putting his foot down, and sometimes it looks as though Linda is making him put his foot down, as though there's various stages of regret as to who ruined this future for Willie. But there's this kind of seemingly, you know, perfect moment where he could have gone off with his brother and become incredibly wealthy. But instead he decided to stay behind because ? You know. But it keeps cutting back. Like, you know, he's this fairy godmother of wealth. And kind of power, right? Because it's not just, well, I mean, at the end of the second act, when he's trying to settle out what he's going to do at the end, it's Ben who comes back, and then Ben's ultimately like, well, you know, $20,000 is $20,000, which is weird. But Ben is kind of this, I don't know, almost like a muse of money, of wealth, of, again, the American dream. You know, if you are willing to take a chance, you could become great.
He represents a kind of success that is very different. It's an antique form of success, even in 1949. It's more of a kind of a Victorian or Edwardian vision of success. It's the success of the frontier. It's the success of colonialism. It's the success of going off and making your way in the world, where it literally means going out into the world and going to Africa or going to the Arctic or wherever success lies. It's not, and the fact that Willie has that as his model of what it means to be successful is quite telling. I mean, he as you mentioned before, and throughout the whole play, he keeps saying that to be a salesman is to be well-liked, and that to be a success in life, what you should be able to do is walk into a room where everyone knows you and people are just happy to hand you work or money or whatever by virtue of your being a popular person. And he is very dismissive of Charlie and of Bernard because they're a couple of nerds, you know, or they're people who just like kept their nose to the grindstone. I mean, Bernard is smart in a way Charlie isn't, but both of them worked hard and they applied themselves and they played the game. They learned what the game was and they played it. They had their success. Charlie, by the end of the play, runs his own business. We're not exactly sure what it is, but
generic business.
But he has a business such that he's able to offer Willie a job. And Bernard is a successful lawyer who is going off to argue cases in front of the Supreme Court. One of the things that makes it difficult for me to pick out what I'm supposed to think about Willie is, on the one hand, yes, this is a play that is supposedly about the failure of the American dream and about the ways in which someone like Willie can work all his life for a job and be cast aside. But on the other hand, Willie is an idiot.
Yes.
And he seems to demean hard work or cleverness or education in favor of connection, of privilege, of a kind of a gentleman's agreement in the world.
Well, and it just keeps boiling down to whether or not he's known. You know, it's like, you know, him telling, like, stories about him ending up in Providence and having, like, coffee with the mayor. As though that helps him sell a single, I guess, women's stockings is what he's selling. But, you know, it's just such a weird, you know, it's a weird concept of what it means to be successful. Because, you know, that scene you were talking about where Bernard is about to go to D.C. to argue his case before the Supreme Court. And, you, I mean, you can sum up Willie's whole character here. But, you know, Charlie comes out, pats his son on the back and says, you know, and hands him, I think, like a bottle of whiskey or something and says, you know, take this, you know, congratulations. And, you know, he says, hey, Willie, you know, he's going to argue a case before the Supreme Court. And Bernard's all embarrassed and says, oh, Dad, well, I'll be back in a few days. I'll see you later. And Willie says, you know, why didn't he even mention it? And, you know, Charlie says he doesn't have to mention it. He's actually going to do it. And all of Willie's life has been making up these stories about how great he is. And Bernard is actually doing something with his life. And that's kind of what comes back around. Like, that summarizes the whole play. And the idea that the Lohman brothers are going to be rich just because they're together. It's just all fantasy. And right. Willie lives only in this fantasy world, so much so that it's literally fighting back by the end of the second act.
Biff, the elder son, the one who was supposed to go on to become a great football star and have a great career in college, but who apparently failed out of math and never made up the course. One of the things that Biff talks about again and again from the first scene is how he doesn't want to have any part of his father's life, that he wants to go work in the outdoors. He wants to work on a farm where he can be happy. And this would seem to be the Marxist theme of the story, the idea of the worker who wants to not be alienated from the products of his labor, who wants to actually do something manual and vigorous with his life rather than something abstracted the way that sales is completely abstracted from the production of goods and services. But on the other hand, while that would seem to support a kind of a Marxist view of this play, on the other hand, Biff is also full of problems. He, as Bernard says, he could have very easily made up this failed grade. He could have gone to college. He could have had all the success he wanted, but he gave up on that. And why Biff gave up on that becomes the big puzzle to be unlocked in Act Two. I've said before that when you read these books as high schoolers, one of the hardest things I think high schoolers have trouble with is the issue of empathy. I think that high schoolers are extremely judgmental, like you never ever will be again in your lifetime when you are between the ages of 16 and about 20. You are convinced that you have everything figured out in life and that the problems that adults face are ridiculous problems because they would just be solved if people would do the right thing, and that the belief that there is a right thing and that it's obvious for anyone is prevalent among high schoolers. But while I was reading this again, I found myself falling back into that high school mode of like, I'm having a hard time sympathizing with either Willie or Biff because they are so much the authors of their own downfall. And I suppose I remembered the parts of the play that put blame on the American dream or upon a capitalist system that uses labor until it's not useful anymore. But this time through the play, all I could see were all those little stupid choices that the characters made that had obvious consequences that anyone could see.
Yeah. You know, in some ways, it's almost like an American version of like a Don Quixote character where he's making his own windmills. You know, he's making monsters that he can't defeat because they're not there. And, you know, in some ways, Miller has very little sympathy for Willie. And you see that at the end, you know, throughout. I mean, his wife catches him try to kill himself in the first act on the bottom of the the furnace, or is it the water heater? Anyway, there's a natural there's a thing where the gas comes in, and there's a little vent for it, and he has a rubber tube which he would use to gas himself, essentially asphyxiate himself. And you know, as I mean, you want to talk about whether or not there's a Marxist interpretation? There's a very strong series of points of view from feminist interpretations of this play, because all the women in this are very weak-willed and not treated very well by the sons, by Willie. And Linda is not at all, has almost no agency until she stands up to her sons near the end of the second act. But the idea that she's afraid to even talk to Willie about him trying to kill himself in the first act comes up. And then ultimately, Biff rubs his face in it, and Willie can't take it. But yeah, no, it's just, it's kind of hard to wrap your mind around when you're, like you said, a high schooler. But you can, like, I don't know, you do see these people who leave high school thinking they're the top of the game, and maybe now it's kind of cultural shorthand that the nerds will inherit the earth, and that the, you know, the kid who was popular in high school does not mean they're going to be popular in college. But this is a really brutal version of it.
In Act Two, Willie has a plan and the two sons have a plan. Willie's plan simply is he's going to go to his boss and ask to be relocated to New York. But the sons have this idea that the two of them together are going to form some sort of a sporting goods
question mark
some sort of a store that they will sell sporting goods, and people would buy from them on the virtue of the fact that Biff was a high school star, I guess. And one of the things that's been built up in Biff's mind is Willie has been telling him to go see this former employer of his, and that he says, well, you were practically a salesman for him, when actually he was a stock boy. But in his mind, he's caught some of the Willie disease of kind of pumping himself up and believing that this is a great idea. And so he runs off to this person's office to, I guess, ask for some investment money on this idea of a sporting goods something. It's very ill-defined.
Well, and I mean, we sound like we're mocking it, but no, it's really like, we'll sell sporting goods, which we will get somehow.
Right.
And then we'll do exhibitions, and we'll have basketball and football teams, and then exhibit them somehow. The Lohman Brothers line. And it's just like, well, and at one point, again, it's fascinating because they immediately fall back into kind of having, almost riffing on this idea of success that their dad has fed them their entire lives. And then halfway through the day, the next day, apparently Biff has this epiphany. Why would he remember me? Why would any of this stuff work out? And Happy's like slapping him around and then immediately goes to try to pick up more women by telling them they look French or something.
Now, one of the problems I have with this play, reading it through this time, is obviously this plan is absurd, but it's hard to tease out in my mind how much of that Miller wants us to think is absurd, wants us as an audience to know is absurd, and how much he wants us to think is plausible, given the fact that this world that everyone inhabits is a very simplified world. You know, it's not a world in which we are given a lot of information about the ins and outs of what it actually means to be a traveling salesman. We aren't given much of the ins and outs of anything. It's kind of, he's not particularly concerned with what people actually do for a play that's about work. He's not particularly concerned with the details of what it means to be a worker.
Mm-hmm.
In general, with this play, I keep wondering to what extent the audience is supposed to think there's something wrong here. For example, in the flashbacks to the high school time, I don't know whether or not the audience is supposed to immediately say this is all crazy thought and has nothing to do with what life was like in the 1920s or whenever this is supposed to take place, this flashback is supposed to take place, or to what extent that just is sort of the shorthand that the play uses.
Well, I mean, but to be fair, it seems like Willy doesn't know how the time works either.
Right.
So the idea is, as Act Two ends, they kind of talk Willy back off the edge by telling him that the next day Biff is going to go see Bill Oliver, the guy who he was a stock boy for, but was convinced that he was this great salesman, as John was saying a second ago. Okay. But then they sit down around the, like, the dinner table, kitchen table, whatever, and Willy goes how to give an interview, all the time essentially shutting Linda up, which drives Biff insane for a reason we'll get to in the second act. But, you know, he says, you know, you were fired because you're too many jokes and whistling in the elevator. What you should do is start with a joke. You know, never pick anything up off the floor. Make sure to make eye contact because there's people to take care of that, and you don't want to make sure you like. And he gives all this weird advice that contradicts each other. And then the next day, Willie's part is that he's going to talk to his boss, like we said. He's going to talk to Howard to see if he can get to stay in New York. And he immediately violates everything. He interrupts him. He yells at him. He tells him stories. He picks things off his desk and picks them off the floor. And you realize that Willy, if he was ever a big deal, and you know, him and Howard will argue about this. I think he had 1 year where he was averaging more than $170 a week. And that was 20 years before the play even takes place. You realize that Willy is so far past even knowing how the world works anymore that he goes from being someone who seems out of it to being almost the subject of fun. And the play comes really close to really kicking him when he's down. Again, it was to your point earlier, John, that it knows so little what to do with Willy that it often seems kind of cruel and farcical, right. Which is hard to wrap your mind around. Because, again, you're creating a character for who the whole play is being told through. And so much of it is optimistic through his eyes that when we realize what the real world is and we're pulled more and more apart by how bleak the real world is versus how optimistic his fantasy is, all until the point where his fantasies get so bleak that that's the point where everything falls apart.
Willy does see his boss in the second act, Howard, and in kind of one of the on-the-nose moments of the play, Howard is playing with a recording device. It's I don't know if it's an early tape recorder or some device, and it's supposed to be the new exciting bit of technology, sort of his new iPhone for that year, and it's just supposed to be a big dig about how life is going on without Willy.
Yeah, and I have it right in front of me if you want me to kind of quote it out at you.
Yeah.
So essentially he has this, like, it's a reel-to-reel tape recorded, like it was saying, and he's playing with it. It's because when Willy comes in, he ignores him completely, and, like, it's his daughter whistling, and then it's his son saying the Capitals. And then Howard goes, you know, they're only $105, and Willy can't afford his insurance payment of $50. So at this point, he can't afford anything. And he goes, You can't do without it. Suppose you want to hear Jack Benny, but you're not home. So you tell the maid to turn on the radio when Jack Benny comes on, so it will automatically go on with the radio. And then you can come home at 12, 1 o'clock, whenever you want, get yourself a Coke and sit down, throw a switch, and in the middle of the night. It assumes he has a maid. He knows that Willy doesn't have a maid. Like, it's crazy. And he doesn't even know to listen to the radio in the car, because Willy has a car that doesn't even have a radio built in.
Willy asks for the New York beat, and Howard says, we really don't have enough of a market here to have that many people here. Plus, we have to keep selling in New England. That's what we do. And again, I know that we're supposed to, as an audience, be feeling bad for Willy at this point and feeling indignant at Howard for not having more loyalty to Willy for all the years that Willy has worked for the company. But Howard makes some pretty good points here. It's sort of like Willy doesn't seem to know how to sell things anyway, so why would they put him in their most important market? And they've got, and that's, you know, that's Willy's job, is selling things in New England. And at first it seems like Howard is just going to say no to Willy, but Willy becomes agitated and yells, And at this point, Howard tells him he's got to be let go. He says that after he spends some time calming down, he'll talk to Willie about maybe getting his job back. Of course, no one believes that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting because I think here is where you and I disagree on the play, because, you know, I think it's later on in the epilogue. You know, Biff gets the line, he had all the wrong dreams. I think we're supposed to assume that Willie doesn't understand. Like, I think since the play is from his perspective, like, we feel sympathy. But I think we're supposed to side here with Howard. And we're supposed to end up siding with what Bill Oliver does to Biff. Like, you know, it's as though the Lohman's world, with, I guess, Happy now taking up the mantle of Willie, is fraudulent. Like, and we're supposed to see that. At least that's how I interpreted by this point, because you're right. Everything that Howard says is true. Willie is babbling, and clearly this is the first time he couldn't even make it as far as Boston, his old stomping grounds. And the last time he went, they put him on commission because he's selling so little. It doesn't make sense for the company to pay him a salary anymore. And everyone's shocked at this, but I think the people who are shocked at it are the people who bought that Willie's stories. The people who didn't buy Willie's stories, you know, like Charlie, aren't surprised. They're like, look, let me give you a job. You can provide for your family and stay home. But Willie is so prideful. He's drunk his own Kool-Aid for so long that he can't let Charlie, the one he thought was weaker, help him out in any way, even though he is taking his money, right? Money that he leaves at the restaurant, but the restaurant, like, the waiter puts back in his pocket.
Now we're getting even more mixed up than the play is in terms of the action here. After Willie gets fired, he goes to see Charlie, and this is the scene we talked about earlier, where Bernard is going off to try a case in front of the Supreme Court. And the pertinent things here are that Willie wants to get a loan from Charlie. Charlie is going to offer him a job, and somehow Willie finds that more demeaning than just taking the money from Charlie. Because I as you've said before, he looks down on Charlie, even though Charlie is by any metric, the more successful of the two. He feels that taking a job from him, I guess, would be admitting that power differential, whereas taking a loan seems, in his mind at least, to be something that people do, friends between each other, even though he never will have the ability to pay back that loan.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I would say is that at this point, Bernard really harps on the fact that Biff gave up on life after he failed his math class. And he says, it was after he went up to see you in Boston, something happened that day. Did something happen? In the most kind of, again, on-the-nose bit of dialogue that is setting up a flashback in the next scene.
Mm-hmm.
Where we finally do get to find out what happened in Boston, and it's that Biff walked in on his father with the woman.
Yeah.
And it's a very strange... This is supposed to be the key to why Biff gave up on life. Now, I can understand Biff giving up on his father after seeing this, or even giving up on his father's dreams for life. But I don't understand why that would turn... That doesn't really explain a lot of other things about Biff, including his kleptomania that it continues to be a problem, because when Biff goes into this interview with the potential investor in his and Happy's sporting goods idea, he ends up stealing a fountain pen off the guy's desk. I'm not particularly concerned about it, because I don't think that people are explained by these single moments in their lives. And certainly something like Kleptomania, I think by the end of the play, Biff talks about how he is always trying to reach for something that he feels he ought to have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's given this kind of, I don't think that people who suffer from kleptomania, it's very easy to characterize why they do. The most surprising people suffer from kleptomania. You know, people like Winona Ryder.
Yeah.
She has an awful lot in life. Why would she be reaching for more? And quite often people who steal, compulsively steal things that have little to no worth. So again, this kind of 1949 psychologizing about it just rubs me the wrong way.
I think it also feeds back to what you said at the very beginning of this, which is that we can't trust what Willie sees in these flashbacks. And so much of the rest of the play, what happens to Biff and Happy, is glossed over. And the kleptomania, the weird mentions that, you know, half the football team is just hanging out in the house waiting for Biff to tell them what to do, doesn't seem to make any sense. But if it's as though Willie points to everything in this moment as much as ever, because, you know, no one else mentions it. You know, Biff never says, "Mom, he was cheating on you," as though there's some big moment. But clearly to Willie, this is where he loses respect. And maybe this is where the play gets the most real, because, you know, Biff goes to visit him in Boston because he's failed the class by whatever, 3 or 4 points. And he figures that Willie, being this great man, if he goes and talks to the teacher, he can get the 4 points and he can graduate. Or, as Bernard says, just go to summer class. You know, you failed one class. It makes me even wonder, like, if he would have actually gone to the University of Virginia. You know, it's all these weird little things that we get that all of a sudden all fall apart. And Biff just says, look, he wouldn't listen to you. And they actually get into this kind of fight where he throws him down. And if you see the movie again, the one on Hulu, which you should because it's there and it's a good version of it, to see John Malkovich loom over Dustin Hoffman and throw him across the room, it's this weird, very terrifying moment, which, since the whole rest of the play has been optimistic in Willie's head, so much so that when people are depressed or trying to pull him back, even in a polite way, he disappears off into fantasy. To have his fantasies literally throw him against a wall. Like, the music drops out, the scene goes dead, and it is terrifying. And you have this moment where you see, on one hand, Biff's childhood is destroyed and his faith in his father is destroyed, and he leaves the play. You know, like, and you, like you said, he's been gone for years. We know that he doesn't show up for at least another month, according to Bernard's stories. And then all of a sudden, his life is effectively changed. And maybe it's that he can't go home again. But one way or another, Willie clearly starts to lose it as well, because he starts to lose it when Linda's fixing her stockings, because the woman was getting stockings from Willie, and his whole kind of perception of where he fits in the world changes with that moment. And then Happy, so interested in getting laid, leaves his father, like, babbling to himself in the bathroom floor. And so there's clearly no redeeming Happy either.
The last sort of sequence of the play, the family reconvenes at home, and Linda is chewing out the kids for having abandoned Willie. Willie shows up and he tries to, there's an attempt at reconciliation, and Biff admits that he's been in prison for stealing, which is one of the reasons why no one's heard from him. There's kind of like this, like, airing of all the dirty laundry that's going on here, but although, pointedly, Biff still does not tell Linda about the affair,
mm-hmm.
It seems like while nothing is resolved, it seems like at least maybe we've reached some sort of stasis here. But as everyone exits the stage, except for Willie, Ben shows up again. Uncle Ben shows up, and Willie returns to thoughts of suicide.
Well, and it's the most heavy-handed little bit, because you know, they leave him in the restaurant and he wants to plant seeds because he has nothing planted because, you know, it's not obvious enough that he's not going to leave anything behind when he leaves, right? Right. And they get into this huge fight, like you're saying, and Biff is just saying, look, I'm not special. I'm not a normal guy. I'm a dime a dozen and so are you. And that's when Willie flips out and goes, look, I'm Willie Loman. You're Biff Loman. We matter, even though our last name is Loman, which is also very on the nose. And, you know, and then in the background, Ben is like, you know, $20,000 is something you can put on the barrel head and really touch. Really touch.
Now, let's mention that what you just said there, because we do have the clip from the play, which is from Biff's last speech about what happened and why he left the interview and didn't get the job.
No. Nobody's hanging himself, Willie. I ran down 11 flights with a pen in my hand today, and suddenly I stopped. You hear me? And in the middle of that office building, do you hear this? I stopped in the middle of that building, and I saw the sky. I saw the things that I love in this world, the work and the food and time to sit and smoke, and I looked at the pen and said to myself, what the hell am I grabbing this for? Why am I trying to become what I don't want to be? What am I doing in an office, making a contemptuous, begging fool of myself when all I want is out there waiting for me the minute I say I know who I am? Why can't I say that, Willie? I'm a dime a dozen and so are you. I'm not a leader of men, Willie. And neither are you. You were never anything but a hard-working drummer who landed in the ash can like all the rest of them. I'm $1 an hour, Willie! I tried 7 states and couldn't raise it. $1 an hour! Do you gather my meaning? I'm not bringing home any prizes anymore, and you're going to stop waiting for me to bring them home. Pop, I'm nothing. I'm nothing, Pop. Can't you understand that? There's no spite in it anymore. It's just what I am. That's all.
The thing about this clip that interests me is it underscores the way in which, again, it's easy to make a kind of a Marxist reading of this play, because the reasons that Biff gives for rejecting his father's vision of success, his vision of the good life, is that it is inauthentic to whom he is, and that the things that he values in life are things that do not have to do with commerce. And so on the one hand, that would seem to point to some of the larger implications of this play. But on the other hand, the play remains a kind of a very small play about very small family drama about infidelity on the one hand and a son discovering the infidelity and feeling as though he's lost all confidence in his father, but he doesn't want to shame his mother.
Well, and then more than that too, it's that Willie is feeling a lot of the same things that Biff is feeling, but unable to explain it. Because in the scene with his boss, Howard, he has almost the same line of, you know, I'm a dime a dozen. He goes, you can't eat the fruit and throw the peel away, right? Like he's feeling like he is someone who's replaceable. But when his son says it, he, you know, slaps him and says, you are not replaceable. You matter. Realizing his own fact that he does no longer matter. Like he doesn't matter at all anymore.
Maybe it's because I already read The Great Gatsby for this. But I feel like The Great Gatsby is another novel which has the veneer of being about the death of the American dream, about the ways in which people believe that we live in a classless society when we actually live in a highly classed society, about the fruitlessness of material, amassing material wealth and all these things. But in the end, it's kind of a tawdry story about a thwarted romance and the jealousy that Gatsby feels for Daisy, and the whole thematic parts about the American dream in some ways seem added on at the end of that book, And it's a wonderful, wonderful ending, and I think it's the reason why people remember that book at all is that last chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like Fitzgerald got to the end of his novel and he said, "Oh, this is just like, you know, a love triangle. Let me make it about something else." And yeah. So he added these lines at the end. And this play, I also feel, is ultimately a kind of a family drama, and all the stuff about the American dream and about the expendability of labor, I feel like that doesn't have as much strength as it might have because of the very fact that Willie is such an idiot, and because he has been given opportunities over and over and over again by the people around him to succeed, even to succeed on the terms that he wants to succeed, and he won't. Because he has a fantasy that ultimately is not so much about the value of labor or the value of being skilled at one's job as it is about the idea of privilege and connectedness.
Sure. Well, I think part of it, too, is, you know, you mentioned, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, his... you know, kind of failure of the American dream is very much an upper class version of the American dream. You know, these mansions in one of various eggs and also involving an affair. You know, this is a very middle class version of the American dream, to have a backyard and a house and a tree in the backyard. And frankly, in some ways, I would say it matters. It's almost more intriguing, more frustrating now, where the middle class as a concept is somehow disappearing. You know, like, you're talking about how in this time period, whether or not, like, the middle class existed as this idea where, you know, you could retire happy and that, you know, Willie, by all accounts, shouldn't be working anymore, and that his buddy Charlie is still working, but he's in charge of his company. Well, that is kind of, in some ways, the middle class version of the American dream in the 1940s and 50s. And Willie, the fact that Willie still has to work, maybe he never achieved that part of his life that he acted like he had achieved when he hadn't. But, you know, and now we have to work longer anyway. You know, we don't get to retire in that same way. So I think it's kind of an interesting, in fact, you know, I think it's interesting that you said this is his most famous play. When I read it, obviously, in high school, I think maybe, like you said, most people read The Crucible. But I think this one is maybe more realistic, since, you know, The Crucible is really about McCarthy, but with witches. you know, it's very little about what actually happened in Salem in some ways. So I think it's just an interesting comparison. But that's a good segue to the epilogue.
Well, let's kill Willie off first.
Yeah, right.
Because the final long scene with Willie is him talking with his imaginary pal Ben, as we've mentioned before, about the goal here is to cash in his life insurance policy. And there has been some discussion before about how, you know, he's not done a very good job of covering his tracks up till now. He could blow it all and the family would have nothing to show for it if the life insurance people determined that it had been a suicide. So he's debating the matter with Ben, and it all comes down to sort of the speculative language about what the proposition is and what the outcome will be. And it's here where I feel like the play almost has a bit of mordant humor to it. I think that the staging with Dustin Hoffman pulls out as much of that as they can. You know, I remember a director friend of mine in college talked admiringly about this sequence because of the way that at the very end, Dustin Hoffman puts on his suit and grabs his hat and he smiles and sighs as he leaves the house all happy and giddy that he's about to pull off this big plan of his, which is to crash his car and kill himself. And I do think that Hoffman does about as much as anyone can do with this role. But maybe because I live in a more ironic time than Miller. I just longed for a little bit more humor, a little bit more humanity. I think that that would make me feel even worse for Willie in the end.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. It is such a hard scene to watch, like, because it's a parallel construction, because you see the, you know, he enters the long hallway of his house the same way at the beginning as he leaves it in the end. He's back in his suit the same way. And, you know, it is kind of darkly funny because in some ways this is the only real plan in the entire play that works. You know, he does actually finally kill himself, which apparently he's been trying to do for months. Problem is, as everyone alluded to, the insurance is not going to buy the story. And Ben, who earlier in the last, second to last scene, tells him it's a terrible idea, starts to agree with him by the end. You know, $20,000 is a pretty good thing to do. So it is, it's very weird. And, you know, they've finally approached him about him trying to kill himself before. And then this time we just hear a car kind of driving off as people say no.
Right. There's a kind of a crazy 1940s, 1950s theatrical bit here where he leaves and everyone screams no, and you're supposed to hear the squealing of the tires and the crash like it's happening just 20 yards away outside the door.
Well, I mean, it's like a Simpsons scene where you just hear him run down the stairs, close the door, and the car speeds off, you know? Like, that's what it is. And it's just, it's supposed to be the emotional height of the play, and it's really kind of comic. It's very bizarre.
The other thing that I can't help but think of is Linda walks off stage, and there's a lot of dialogue that she has off stage where she's shouting, you know, aren't you coming up to bed, as Willie puts on his jacket and leaves. And I realize that what's happening here is the actress has to get off stage for a quick change into her funeral dress. I think that Miller timed it for just as long as she could possibly get off, have her off stage costume change, and then reappear, because she has to reappear almost immediately after the crash.
In one of the saddest speeches at the end. Yes. Because the sons have a philosophical debate with each other and then with Charlie. And then she's like, well, I can't cry. And you just, oh, it's so heartrending. Especially since the way they do it, she's looking at the audience. You know, she's facing directly out, which is in the stage direction, you know.
Well, it becomes very, very theatrical at this point. Yeah. Charlie's speech is also enormously theatrical, and he even adapts a kind of a antique manner speech where he says, "No one dast blame him," and it feels suddenly like the play has jumped backwards, you know, maybe 20, 30 years again to something by Eugene O'Neill, because it's sort of like a series of short monologues where, as you mentioned, the brothers are going to talk about what the political implications are here, and Charlie is suddenly more sympathetic to Willie than he seems to have been through the entire play, and says that we must take note of him and must take note of his life. And then, as you mentioned, Linda has a final address that's just completely pathos about Willie. We paid off the house, you know.
You guys already did Romeo and Juliet. Like, this is this is a Shakespearean dramatic ending. People right. die. It's the emotional, like, everything they worked for their entire life has literally gone up in smoke, because just as he finally owns something, right? The whole thing he's complaining that Charlie gets to own things, I never get to own anything, he's dead. Right? And you know, Charlie, like, and I guess this is also the only scene not through Willie's eyes, although I guess it might be. We don't know. This could be his funeral. Although I imagine, as Linda said, who drank his Kool-Aid for 20 years, you'd think someone else would have shown up. But it's just them at the end. Because literally no one shows up for this, you know, death of a salesman. Which is, again, so sad on the nose that it's it's almost cartoonish. Like, if at any point you're watching this or reading it and you don't buy any of these characters, this is incredibly cheesy. Right. That's why maybe the Dustin Hoffman version is the one that sticks, because you're going to believe Dustin Hoffman. Everyone in that version can act, but otherwise you're just standing around while people are talking. Again, Charlie talks Shakespearean. Like, who says no one dost blame this man? Like, yeah. It's an interior construction which hasn't existed in a century and a half.
Right.
So, anyway.
So, yeah. So, as we mentioned before, this is a kind of an unrelentingly depressing play. And I hope we've been able to bring a little bit of levity here. I feel like this is a play that's just kind of can't quite decide whether it wants to be ultimately about a kind of a sordid, sad family drama, or whether it wants to be about bigger ideas about what it means to be a worker in a world that disposes of workers. And I know that a lot of people would say, well, can't it be both? And certainly it could be both, but I don't feel like it quite resolves that in my mind. It feels like it goes back and forth between the two in a kind of an uncomfortable way. I mean, there's a lot about this play that I find highly admirable, and certainly I see it as really important to the American theater. I just don't know that I would ever want to watch another production of it again in my life.
You know, I don't want to agree with you, because I like this so much, and I've gone back to it. And as someone who teaches U.S. history at the university level, I think it's really hard for people to wrap their minds around sometimes, like in the early Cold War, how we wanted so bad to beat the Soviets that we create this world of, well, people are happy working and being able to buy stuff, and that this American dream is not just having, you know, the car in a garage and the chicken in the pot that Herbert Hoover promises before the Great Depression, but that, you know, that being able to work and do what you want creates a life for yourself. This is, you know, like, but at times it gets so heavy-handed, you know, like contextualizing it. And then seeing people who are incredible actors. I think, you know, Malkovich deserves all the credit in the world for someone like Biff, who's a very difficult character to do. But man, it's draining. It's really emotionally draining. And at the end of Act One, I can't imagine the discussions that would happen during an intermission. Because you're just like, so this is just bleak and bleak and bleak.
I imagine everyone just walked out to the lobby and smoked.
Right. That's exactly it.
It was 1949, after all. Everyone just smoked.
Yeah, and apparently the first run of this was like 746 shows. Like, it must have been like a huge splash. But at the same time, you know, even if you don't buy all the emotion, and I think you're right, I think it comes off cheesy now. Apparently when he was given his kind of Lifetime Achievement Awards, conservatives went up in arms. George Will gave this kind of write-up in The Atlantic about, you know, Arthur Miller as this kind of fake version of the American dream. Like to your point, I had this feeling, you know, rereading this, that in some ways maybe it's best to read this to high schoolers, kind of like Catcher in the Rye, where in high schoolers, you get what a phony is. And, you know, there's not a lot of gray area. Here, the emotions are just so over the top that you either buy them or you don't, but there's not a lot of gray area by the end. It's just kind of weird. But, you know, I appreciate the opportunity to kind of come back to it, because I'm kind of dropped the name of it. You know, I mentioned parts of it so much because, you know, it is kind of part of our dramatic heritage as Americans. That it's rare that I just sit down and reread a play like this. So it's kind of interesting to do. And I'd say for that, if you as an audience listening to us talk about this, you've never done, I'd say it's at least worth seeing once, even if, you know, John's never setting foot in the theater again, you know.
Thanks again to co-host Nicholas Hoffman. His podcast is called Myopia, Defend Your Childhood. The reading this time was by the indefatigable Phil Gonzalez, whose podcast is still Deep in Bear Country. If you'd like to write in to suggest a book to read, or just to say hi, you may do so at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Also, you can join us on the Sophomore Lit Facebook page, where we discuss books, have book clubs, and do other Facebook-type stuff. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Visit theincomparable.com for more smart, funny podcasts. And remember, everything will be on the final.
So does he die in the end?
Biff, they all die.
Okay.
All except Willie.
What? Seriously?
No. Oh. It's an ironic title.